Welcome, everyone, to The Hum and the Silence, Volume 8. In this episode, I'm going to bring you some supplementary Year of the Humanoids material. We'll get to a little more in depth on a handful of the abduction cases that took place in October of 1973 and some other incidents that occurred actually around Missouri. So the first involves a lady named Alice, and this is a little bit that I cut from the Piedmont Lights portion of part one. And it's kind of a family history of a few different things, but a lady called Alice has decided to share her and several generations of her family's experiences from the 1850s to the present day with what she calls, quote, little people of the night. Alice was 96 in 2016 when she shared the story to a Missouri UFO investigator. Alice's family has lived on a farm in Wayne County in southeast Missouri since the 1850s. Quote, I lived on the farm with my mother, father, grandfather, and siblings, Alice said. The actual family farm was located near a railhead that was planted in 1871. Quote, when I was a kid, whoever was the youngest had to sleep on the sleeping porch of the house. None of us wanted to sleep there because the little people would visit, and we were all afraid of them, Alice said. I remember that my mother and grandmother told stories about the little people who visited the farm at night, and that the stories were in the family since before the Civil War. It was in the late summer of 1930 that Alice's close encounter began. One night in particular, when I was 10 years old, I was laying in bed on the porch, and I saw a gray being with big eyes walk up to the window and look inside at me. I was frozen in fear. He just kept looking at me. The next thing I knew, there were three of them, all about 4 feet tall with no hair, big black eyes, small noses and mouths, and thin, standing next to my bed. I remember thinking I had no idea how they got inside. I was even more afraid and wanted to pull the covers over my face, but couldn't. I didn't know what happened after that. The next morning I woke up and they were gone, Alice said. They never appeared during the day, only at night. I never saw a craft of any type, but sometimes, late at night, we would hear a humming sound coming from the low depression area around the pond, about 100 feet from the house, but never went to look and see what it was. I think we were afraid to. I don't know what happened after that, Alice recounted, that all of the family members frequently saw glowing objects all over the property. Quote, we often saw small white balls of light in the yard, around the farm at dusk and after dusk, but never knew what they were. The lights were about the size of a softball. The whole family was sure to be inside after dark, and we just didn't play outside after dark. The older family members made sure we came inside, and as I think back on this, it must have been because of the little people who would take us. That is the term my mother and grandmother used. They would say that the little gray people would take us at night, but always brought us back before morning. Alice seemed to feel that the experiences were magical in some way. It was almost like talking about fairies or something magical that was our little secret, she said. It was not something we spoke about to other people. We kept it to ourselves and still do to this day. I still see them sometimes, only inside the house where I sleep now. I see them come in late at night, usually around 3 a.m., but for some reason I just fall asleep and don't remember any interaction with them. I don't let anyone sleep on the porch, though. My children and grandchildren have also seen the gray people. We are not so afraid of them anymore. Just look at them as being visitors rather than something that will harm us. Alice mentioned that she had feared ridicule of not only herself, but her children and grandchildren if her real name was revealed. But she also felt it was important to have the encounters recorded. When you crack David Webb's Year of the Humanoids report, the introduction mentions 4 cases that became infamous in 1973 some of them kind of faded into obscurity after that a little bit. You know, there's the Pascagoula abduction, which he doesn't go into, you know, too much into detail. The coin helicopter case, again, he doesn't really cover that. It's not a humanoid sighting. There was a report of a USO seen in Pascagoula 1 month after Charlie and Calvin's abduction that was seen by a number of people, including the Coast Guard. And it's funny because a lot of them just kind of poked at it with an oar. That's another weird and interesting story. But there's one remarkable story that doesn't get enough credit. And it's the story of a man named Eddie Webb, a truck driver from Greenville, Missouri. And here's a pair of articles that were written in the Southeast Missourian from October 4th and 5th, 1973. There's a couple of follow-up articles here that I'm going to share with you all. But Eddie Webb of Greenville, who says he was temporarily blinded by a flash after he observed an unidentified flying object on Interstate 55 near Cape Girardeau early Wednesday, rests at his home and draws a sketch of the object he observed. He wears the dark glasses to protect his eyes from the light, as he is still unable to see more than 3 feet, and then only with blurred vision. Encounter with UFO Frightening by John G. Adney and Reginald E. Mitchell. An encounter with an unidentified flying object near Cape Girardeau has left a Greenville truck driver shaken over what he claims he saw in the 2 to 3 minutes before unusual flashing lights disappeared. Eddie Webb, 45, a driver for Sam Tanksley's Trucking Incorporated of Cape Girardeau, claims to have made contact the hard way with the UFO. Thank you for that. The hard way. All I could think of in my head hearing that is that portion of from Back to the Future 2 right before Marty's knocked out. And you hear that guy's voice go, "The easy way." Yeah, that's the kind of vibes I get from that. Today, he is the center of attention as UFO sightings become more widespread throughout the area. Mr. Webb was given emergency eye treatment at Southeast Missouri Hospital here and further treatment at Cape Girardeau Ophthalmologist's Office. The State Highway Patrol is holding his twisted, nearly melted pair of eyeglasses as evidence that something unusual happened, although Mr. Webb is the only one to claim that he actually saw what he thinks is a UFO. His wife, Velma May, also a truck driver, and who was with him when the incident occurred, says she saw nothing, which is interesting. You know, they were driving together. She didn't see anything. But again, this is an interesting case because the glasses speak to a lot of this. But and the doctor who treated Mr. Webb says he cannot confirm any type of injuries. But Mr. Webb sticks to his story that he was temporarily blinded and burned. His wife believes him, and the highway patrol is puzzled. The story he relates seems fantastic, almost unbelievable, but even the UFO skeptics who have seen the glasses frames twisted by a hot flash of unknown origin admit that there is something to the story. Mr. Webb gave a detailed account of the incident to the Missourian Wednesday in a telephone conversation and later in an interview at his home in a secluded wooded area near Greenville in Wayne County. Mr. Webb, relaxing at home Wednesday night in a reclining chair and wearing sunglasses, appeared exhausted and shaken by his experience. His forehead appeared slightly red as it had received a mild sunburn, and he complained frequently of pain which went deep inside his forehead and eyes. His sight had partially returned and he could see with blurred vision for about 3 feet, he said, but still flinched at bright lights. He said his encounter with what he calls a turnip-shaped UFO with red and yellow lights in the center occurred between 6:15 and 6:30 a.m. Wednesday on Interstate 55 just south of the Jackson exit at Wedekin Park. He was driving a southbound Tanksley tractor-trailer rig. Miss Webb herself, a truck driver for 16 years, was beside him in the cab when he first noticed in his rearview mirror the unusual lighted object behind his truck. Mr. Webb said the time span from when he first saw the light behind him until he was blinded by a bright flash was only 2 to 3 minutes. He and his wife had alternated driving from Parkersburg, West Virginia. That's right. Parkersburg, West Virginia. Interesting Indrid Cold connection here. Where they had picked up a load of raw plastic material repackaged in 1,000-pound boxes. Mr. Webb had driven the last leg from Effingham, Illinois, to the I-55 rest stop north of Fruitland, where they rested and left at about 6 a.m. About 15 minutes later, just after they had passed the Jackson exit, Mr. Webb first noticed the lights of the object, about a mile behind him. He said from this far away, all he noticed was the lights, only red and yellow, glittering and mixing together. He said the lights were about 4 to 5 feet off the ground, and at first he thought it was a flatbed trailer's lights, or someone running without their headlights. He said he was driving his rig about 55 or 60 miles per hour, and the lights appeared to be moving 3 to 4 times as fast as he was and were rapidly gaining on him. Quote, "When I saw the lights, I told my wife that something was coming up behind us real fast," he said. "But when she looked out her mirror, she said she didn't see anything at all. I looked out my rearview mirror and saw them again, this time much closer," he continued. He said he saw an object which looked like a big turnip, almost like his truck, and for an instant got a glimpse of it. The bottom and top sections were spinning and looked like they were made from aluminum or chrome, he said in describing the object. The center section had the lights on it and wasn't spinning, but the lights were glittering and the red and yellow seemed to mix together. He said the object appeared to be about 30 feet in diameter, with part of it covering the other lane of the road and the other part hidden behind his truck. He said the lights were about 4 feet off the ground and that it must have been at least 10 feet in height. As he got a glimpse of the object, almost on the tail of his truck and ready to hit him, the truck entered a patch of fog, he said. Mr. Webb stuck his head out the window and looked back toward the object. Quote, "I saw something which looked like a light from a spotlight come down on the tandem of the trailer. And at the same time, the object started to rise higher in the air," he said. He said up to the time the object caught up with his truck, he had heard no motor noise. But as it started to rise, he noticed a humming sound, which seemed to rise in frequency as the lights rose higher. Mr. Webb said, quote, "I stuck my head out a little further, looked back, and a bright white flash, like a ball of fire, hit me in the face. When the light flashed, everything stopped, the noise and all, and the lights went out." Miss Webb said her husband, after looking out the window on the driver's side of the cab, quote, "pulled his head back in and screamed. He put his hands over his eyes and screamed that he couldn't see." Miss Webb said she never saw any of the lights or heard the humming noise. "At first I thought my truck lights had gone out, so I put on the brakes and stopped in the middle of the road," Mr. Webb said. "My wife told me I was cracking up and to gel in the bunk of the cab and let her drive. It was then I realized I'd gone blind." Miss Webb turned a light on in the truck and looked at her husband to find his forehead red and hot, as if it were blistered. One lens had fallen out of his glasses, and the frame was melted and twisted. After the truck was halted, Miss Webb took over and drove to the Tanksley complex on Highway 61 South, near Municipal Airport. She said they had arrived around 6:45. An ambulance was called to the Tanksley office to take Mr. Webb to the hospital. He was given emergency treatment, and a doctor examined him at about 7:30 a.m. Mr. Webb was taken to the doctor's office at about 8:30, where he remained most of the morning. Mr. Webb's glasses have also been brought to the center of attention. Police who looked at the glasses said they didn't know whether the, quote, melting and twisting had been caused by heat or acid. Sergeant Edwin E. Wright of the State Highway Patrol took the glasses to Poplar Bluff to have them sent to the patrol's laboratories in Jefferson City. He said, however, the glasses were to be returned to Cape Girardeau and tests would be run on them today by Dr. Harley C. Rutledge, head of the SEMO, State University Physics Department, in an effort to determine what caused them to melt. Dr. Rutledge has been involved during the past 6 months in a scientific investigation of mysterious lights and UFOs. I'm assuming he's talking about the Piedmont lights, which would make sense because we're still in Missouri here. The Cape Girardeau doctor who examined Mr. Webb at the hospital and in his office said he ran several tests and made x-rays but could turn up no signs of burns, blindness, or other injuries. I can confirm nothing, the ophthalmologist said. Dr. John Engelhardt of Lutzville, the Webb's family physician, theorized that it could have been some type of laser beam which caused the glasses to be distorted. A policeman thought it might have been gas formed by the load of plastic in the trailer. But when the trailer was checked, there was no damage to the cargo or the truck, authorities said. Whatever it wasn't a helicopter or a motor vehicle, Mr. Webb said. He added that his wife saw nothing past them, so whatever it was must have gone up over the top of the trailer. He admitted that he was frightened, first when they thought something was going to run into the back of the trailer. And it didn't, and again, everything went black, he said. As far as UFOs and flying saucers are concerned, I always figured that someone who saw them either was pilled up or had been drinking, Mr. Webb said. But I don't do either, and I saw something unexplainable, so now I just don't know. I'm almost afraid to think of what I saw. I think someone might have put me in a straitjacket. Despite the incident, Miss Webb says she still does not believe in UFOs. I never saw the lights. I didn't see anything, she said. But I heard my husband scream and I saw his glasses. I know he was frightened and that he was in pain. I saw burns on his forehead and around his eyes. I was really scared, she continued. I still don't believe in UFOs. I don't think there have ever been any. There is an October 5th article that deals with the examination of Eddie's glasses. Investigation today centered around a pair of eyeglasses which were worn by Eddie Webb, 45, of Greenville, who claimed he saw an unidentified flying object and was hit in the face by a ball of fire which blinded him Wednesday near Cape Girardeau. Above principal investigators in the case, Sergeant Edwin E. Wright of the State Highway Patrol, and Dr. Harley D. Rutledge, head of the SEMO State University Physics Department, confer Thursday as Dr. Rutledge prepared to start a series of tests on the glasses. Below are the glasses shown, slightly twisted, and with pit marks caused by some form of heat. So I will be including an image with this post of the glasses and of the images associated with these articles from the Southeastern Missourian. Distorted Glasses Attention Getter by Reginald E. Mitchell. A pair of eyeglasses became the center of attention today in the story of a Greenville truck driver who claims he saw an unidentified flying object and then was hit in the face with a ball of fire which temporarily blinded him. The eyeglasses were damaged when Eddie Webb, 45, of Greenville, a driver for Sam Tanksley's Trucking, Inc. of Cape Girardeau, encountered the UFO while he was driving a tractor-trailer rig on Interstate 55 just south of the Jackson exit in Wedekind Park, about 6:15 or 6:30 Wednesday morning. Dr. Harley Rutledge, head of the physics department at SEMO State University, said that a cursory examination of the eyeglasses briefly Thursday under a microscope and the plastic frame appeared to have been heated internally. I was quite surprised. It doesn't look like a hoax at this point, he said. Dr. Rutledge is a director of Project Identification, and with the aid of members of the Southeast Missouri Astronomy Club, is continuing a scientific investigation of nocturnal lights, which he began this spring in the Piedmont area. Again, alluding to the Piedmont lights sightings at this point. It had been a good, I want to say, 6 to 8 months since those sightings had started to occur when Eddie Webb had his encounter in October. And would this technically count? I'm not sure. This might count as part of the Piedmont lights, but their sightings kind of died off after a certain period. He said that in literature on UFO sightings, such burn marks as are evident on the glasses' frames are said to have been caused by sound waves of high intensity. Mr. Webb told the Missourian Wednesday that he and his wife were in the tractor's cab headed toward Tanksley when he saw an unusual lighted object. The large turnip-shaped object covered both lanes of the interstate and appeared to have three sections, the top and bottom made of aluminum and spinning, while the center section was steady and comprised of glittering red and yellow lights. The driver said he awoke his wife, who was sleeping in the cab, but she didn't see anything out her rearview mirror. He stuck his head out of the window and to look behind, and seconds later was blinded by a bright flash which felt, quote, like a large ball of fire which struck me about the head and face, he said. Mr. Webb was temporarily blinded, but later his vision began returning and he could see with blurred vision for about 3 feet. He was treated by a Cape Girardeau ophthalmologist who found no damage to his eyes and was scheduled to see a specialist in St. Louis today. One thing which seems to substantiate Mr. Webb's story is that whatever struck his glasses did not come from directly ahead, but from slightly to the left, Dr. Rutledge said. This is what you would expect from a person looking to the rear from a truck window. The glasses, which were melted and slightly twisted, bear pit marks which Dr. Rutledge said resemble craters caused by bubbles coming from the inside of the plastic to the surface and then bursting. He said two major tests will be made on the glasses' frames, a test for residues performed by the Law Enforcement Assistance Council Crime Lab at the university, and a nuclear fluorescence test for radioactivity, which he will conduct. Dr. Rutledge said he would also study the pattern of damage to the frames in detail under a microscope and test an undamaged portion of the frames to see if he can reconstruct the damage pattern. He said the test should be completed within 3 to 5 days. Dr. Rutledge pointed out that there have been reports of events similar to that experienced by Mr. Webb, where a ball of light has struck a person in the forehead. He also said that the turnip or top-shaped object is one of the most frequently reported shapes for UFOs, along with disc and cigar shapes. I don't know that that's necessarily true. Turnip-shaped objects are not that common. And the image that you will see of this object, it does look like a turnip with, like, stripes on it. It's an interesting one. It's Eddie Webb's own personal drawing that I'll include with this post. 2 years later, there was a follow-up article on August 14th, 1975, and it was about a settlement Eddie received from workers' compensation that he had filed following the incident. A September 15th hearing on the application for workman's compensation filed by a Greenville man who claims he was injured by an unidentified flying object, UFO, near Cape Girardeau in 1973 has been canceled after a settlement was reached between the plaintiff and insurance company for his employer, Sam Tanksley Trucking Incorporated. Amount of settlement could not be divulged since it must be first approved by workman's compensation, the company said. Eddie Webb, 47, a truck driver from Greenville, became the central figure of one of Southeast Missouri's strangest UFO tales after reporting he was burned on the face and temporarily blinded when an unidentified flying object shot a, quote, ray or, quote, ball of fire at him as he was driving his truck on Interstate 55 here in October 1973. Mr. Webb filed for compensation, claiming he was injured while on the job. He asked benefits to pay about $1,000 in hospital and doctor's bills and compensation for the period of several weeks after the incident when he said he could not work. So Eddie Webb's here, you know, claim here is it's pretty reasonable, I would say. You know, dude missed some time, had some unforeseen circumstances happen to him. If you choose to accept his story that he was blinded by a UFO, and there's some, you know, interesting evidence here. But again, his claim is not unreasonable, I don't think. In February, Edwin F. Ragland of the Missouri Division of Workmen's Compensation granted Mr. Webb's request for compensation, but later vacated the order calling for partial or temporary award. Mr. Ragland said he wanted another hearing to examine all issues involved, and the September 15th date was set. The Workmen's Compensation Office here said the parties involved in the case had notified the office of the settlement, which they are asking to be approved. Mr. Webb's story gained national fame, and he was questioned by several top UFO investigators. Dr. Harley Rutledge, head of the physics department at Semmes State University, examined a pair of burned, twisted glasses allegedly worn by Mr. Webb at the time of the incident. Dr. Rutledge said he was able to reproduce the unusual burned effects on the glasses through use of a common highway flare, although he could not prove that Mr. Webb's story was untrue. So that's interesting. Now we have a reproducible effect here. But why would Eddie Webb be missing with a flare outside his window? That doesn't make sense. But like, I think what that does indicate is that maybe, you know, a bright flash of something. He did see something. So what that bright flash was, I'm not sure. Assuming like magnesium is something that's in road flares that might be responsible. I don't know. I haven't really looked into that, but it's one thought that I've had. So we're going to shift now to the abduction cases. And there are two that I want to bring up, two that kind of are a little more well known within certain sects of the UFO community. And the first is that of Brian Scott. On October 25th, 1973, Scott and his teenage babysitter named Jeannie observed a UFO 100 feet above them in Buena Park, California. They described their, quote, minds being lifted up to the craft and then returned within an hour and a half of missing time. In David Webb's report, this is case number 37A, and the report reads, quote, Buena Park, California. One of a complex series of alleged contacts, mysterious lights, and automatic writing involved Brian Scott. The first contact was on October 12, 1955. The next on March 14, 1971, involved an apparent abduction and return with a possible other man. On March 21, 1973, he repeated his 1971 Arizona experience, which had involved a 9-foot being and a short, squat one called, quote, the host. On October 25th, Scott saw an object with blinking lights on the bottom surrounded by haze. He drove to his home to get someone else to see it and returned with his teenaged babysitter. They both felt as if their minds had been lifted up to the craft, bathed in green light, and returned. Scott saw short humanoids, but felt that this vague encounter was unplanned, and with different humanoids than in his earlier experiences. A period of an hour and a half could not be accounted for. Preliminary interviews have raised questions about the witness's credibility, though events of a psychic nature continue to occur to him and to members of his family. First-hand investigation. In 1973, contact-like experiences like this were not common, unless you're talking about the contactees, but by this time, there aren't a lot of contactees. They're not making the headlines like they used to. You may catch occasional stories about like George Adamski or, you know, Truman Bethlehem or somebody from like the 50s that, you know, might make the headlines again. But by and large, the contactees, the UFO community had moved away from them. And if you read the literature in, you know, from the 50s and up until about the mid 60s, they were kind of generous to the contactees in many ways. The writers were absolutely generous in the praise that they gave them and their cases. But with Brian Scott's case, he's not talking about human looking aliens. He's talking about, well, we're going to get into what he's talking about. I'm going to highlight two of the incidents that were mentioned in this report. The first being the October 12th, 1959 incident. On that particular day, it was Brian's 16th birthday. And that evening, while walking home from a party with his dog, an orange ball of light, less than a foot in diameter, hovered above his dog. He stared into the orb as it approached him, settling right in front of his face. Then the object shot straight up into the air, moving fast out of sight. Brian was left with the impression that some kind of communication had taken place that involved images and thoughts entering his mind. 12 years later, Brian would experience his first abduction within the Superstition Mountains. In March of 1971, he had driven out to the mountains with his friend Nick Corbin in the open desert outside of Phoenix, Arizona. Brian would reflect on this years later, but he wasn't sure why they had stopped at this particular area. He seemed to recall that it was the ideal place for target shooting. In a Flying Saucer Review article about this particular UFO incident, it indicates that they were actually camping. And I'm going to quote directly from the FSR article going forward with this incident. While camping on the Arizona desert around 9 p.m., the subject, Brian, and a friend, Nick, are levitated into a 200-foot diameter saucer-shaped UFO. The subject finds himself and witness in a small room, paralyzed and unable to resist. Suddenly, several 7-foot-tall beings enter and undress them both, then take them in opposite directions down a curving hallway. The beings are ugly, with sloping shoulders, crocodile-scaled skin, elephant-like feet, and hands with 3 fingers and a recessed thumb. The interesting thing about the sketch of these things, and in a later book that was written about Brian's experiences, they kind of look like the Easter Island heads. That's the way that their heads are kind of shaped. There's one hilarious image that I'm going to include with the post for this episode that shows these two beings behind, like, they look like they're behind podiums and there's a door next to them. It looks like they're on like a game show and they don't look like they're pleased to be there. They stop at a door with an insignia on it. There are blinking lights at the top and sides. When touched by one of the beings, the door seems to explode and the subject moves into a very bright room. After actually walking some distance, he is placed against a curving wall, from which he is unable to move. The wall lights up, and he feels pleasant. 2 of the 7-foot beings station themselves at consoles of some kind. Again, they look absolutely miserable in front of these consoles. And a third stands beside a pole on which there is a movable box with many tiny colored blinking lights and 2 large intense lights. One of these large lights holds the subject's eyes in a fixed gaze. The other is apparently some sort of biological probe. The subject experiences a series of uncomfortable, if painless, sensations from his feet upward. He senses he is bleeding. He urinates. He feels water run from his stomach. He feels his chest opened, and he thinks his heart has left his body briefly. Finally, his head feels pulled violently. Then everything stops, and shortly, the lights on the box go out. The subject senses that the intense lights on the box are connected with blinking lights on the box, which seem to traverse a clear cable leading from the moving box to the pole, and perhaps up the pole to another level. The subject detects a distinct, unpleasant odor. Then from across the room, out of the fog, comes a 9-foot being, like the others, only larger. He approaches the subject, who is frightened, but calms suddenly when the being places his huge hand on the subject's head. The 9-foot apparently communicates telepathically with the subject, without moving his mouth. A message is communicated to the subject. Then the subject experiences an out-of-body trip. The message is a combination of vague philosophical statements, general information about the alien's origin and purpose, and a promise that they will return. That is the typical summation of most, you know, communication between abductee and abductor. That's what it's like. The aliens seem to the subject to be clones or of a central host intelligence in the form of a vast onboard computer. The host once had humanoid form, but now can either inhabit the computer or materialize as a humanoid. So if you've ever wanted to exist as an AI in a computer. This is the abduction for you. I'm telling you, you need to find these beings and figure out how they can just put themselves into whatever organic, artificial body that they want to create. There is a large lab on the second floor of the UFO where young clones are grown in cylinders. The ship is checking the original biological plantation on Earth. The subject's telepathic trip is through future time to the alien's home, a harsh purplish world domed with two suns. However rugged its geography, the subject senses that it is a very happy place. On the way to the alien's home, the subject views Earth during a future war. Bright flashes apparently signify total atomic destruction. Dates given for this doomsday range from April 3rd, 1985 to December 24th, 2011, but settle on June 7th, 1985 at high noon exactly. Woo! We've made it! We survived! It's best not to put dates of your doomsday destruction predictions in your UFO reports. I want you all to know that going forward. Don't put dates in there. All you have to do is you have to come out of the woodworks later and say, oh yeah, I totally predicted that. The beings told me that, you know, this would happen. But like when you start to put dates, that's when you start to look like a fool. The subject is taken from the wall and returned down the curving hall to the small room where he meets his friend, who looks weak and ashen. They dress and then are floated to the ground. They stumble around in the darkness until they find their camp. About 2 hours has passed. Neither remembers what has happened, but frightened and disoriented, they frantically throw all their gear into their truck and race home. Dr. A.H. Lawson regressed Brian Scott. A.H. Lawson is a UFO investigator slash dude who can regress people from California. The article that I'll be including in the sources for this episode is kind of like his work with experiencers and kind of the data that he's collected. But the main feature of this case is Brian Scott's abduction. Dr. A.H. Lawson regressed Brian Scott and noted that when recalling information, it was as if he had access to two different streams of info, one that was suppressed and one that wasn't. Under his findings, quote, there was a surprise factor in the subject's narrative, which consistently electrified the investigators, who felt the subject's responses to be beyond his powers of invention. For instance, he would answer some questions eagerly, with a rush of words, then trail off in confusion with a mumbled, I don't understand. As if there were two channels of information, his own and another. Lawson notes that Brian had been arrested for fraud and spent some time in jail. Yet despite this, Lawson held the case high because of the level of detail. One detail that Brian noted is that he saw a door with a symbol on it. In short, it basically kind of looks like a tree that is slightly unfinished. And within this tree, or outside this tree, is like an unfinished circle. And I will include an image of that with the post on Patreon. I think to see the images, you either need to have the app, or I think you need to view it on their website. It's kind of a pain in the ass how they don't come up on their own, but you do what you can with the tools that you have. There is a more complete recollection of this encounter in particular, and there's a book that was written that I can't remember off the top of my head, but I will include a link to it in the description, so if you guys want to check it out, you can check it out. It's like $2.99 on Kindle. Otherwise, it's like $20 for a paperback. And I think the Kindle version says it's like 800 pages. So it's a long one. But Brian Scott's story seems to be a pretty controversial one. And it's one that I want to cover in depth at some point on the podcast. So this is where I'm going to leave his story for now. And this is the last story I want to cover. It's the story of a woman named Patty Roach. And her experiences are a series of, well, it's one experience, but like it involves practically her entire family, also members of her neighborhood. And I will say the methods of investigation when you read about it, particularly in Kevin Randall's book, The October Scenario, it's painful. Because this case involves not only regressing Patty herself, but regressing her kids who were very young, like too young to be regressing. This is a note for all of you. Don't fucking hypnotically regress children. It's fucked up. Like it's incredibly fucked up. On the night of October 16th, 1973, Patty Roach was home with her children that night. She had fallen asleep on the couch. Her youngest son, Kent, was asleep next to her. He woke shortly after midnight, frightened of a skeleton in the corner of the room. The cat was howling and a dog across the street was barking loudly, and soon the other children were awake, too. There were reports of a prowler in the neighborhood, which led Patty to phone the police. They were prompt but unable to find any evidence of a prowler. After the police left, it was Kent who said to his mother, "They were spacemen." This statement was like a prompt for her. She remembered a bright light and a rustling noise outside the house. Her youngest daughter, Debbie, had a conscious recall of the events of that night. She described everything, the abduction, the ship, the beings. Patty dismissed her immediately, chalking it up to good imagination. Quote, "They told me not to tell anyone except those in my family," Debbie told her mother. She also became violently ill after the police left. It wasn't until she read the story of Dionisio Yanka in the UFO report that she reached out to investigators for help. It's interesting because Dionisio Yanka, we've covered Dionisio's story on the podcast. Spencer was on for that episode. But it is considered part of the Year of the Humanoids. It occurred in the same time period in that October window. There is this October window between October 11th and October 28th in which these abductions took place. And I forgot to mention, this abduction occurred in Lehigh, Utah at the time. Under hypnosis through Dr. James Harder of APRO, she recalled a bright light waking her and two figures standing over her. They were 4 feet tall and slim. Their arms were long and ended in claws with opposable thumbs. Their clothes were fluorescent, accented by a brown belt and gloves. The alien seized her by the arms and lifted her. She was terrified, worried for her kids. She described them all standing in the living room, with the exception of Kent, who was being carried by one of the beings. They carried a machine with them, described as a briefcase that stood on three short legs. They left it in the living room as they were taken on board the ship. With a being on each side, she was escorted into a room where 4 or 5 beings were gathered. She described them as cold and uncaring. The room was round, and through the top she could see what she described as stars. There were machines and buttons giving off their own light. She was blunt about the examination and refused to describe what had happened to her and who could blame her in a situation like that. She was scared for her kids and scared for her life. Moments later, in the hypnosis, they were floated back into their home, all of them. Then, in the next moment, she was waking up to Kent screaming about a skeleton in the room. When Dr. Harder pushed her, she told him that they were interested in our brains, how we thought and experienced emotions. She suddenly emerged from the trance on her own without any prompting. Patty also detailed a set of triangular marks on her and Bonnie, her daughter's skin, in the shape of an inverted triangle. One of her neighbors recalled seeing the marks as well, but they dismissed them entirely. At one point, they regressed her youngest daughter, Debbie, who remembered seeing an Indian girl on the ship. Quote, "She was dark and had on a long dress." One of the beings talked to her telepathically, reassuring her that she wouldn't be sick anymore. She had been sick before they showed up and felt drastically better after their visit. But again, as I mentioned earlier, when the police came to visit, she ended up feeling ill after they left. So apparently they didn't fully come through on that promise, but, you know, it is what it is. She described seeing several people standing in a line waiting to get on the machine, as she put it. This machine had dials on it and appeared to float in the air. Along with seeing her sister Bonnie, there were two other children from the neighborhood in line. The investigation of this case made me uneasy, to say the least. Again, Harder's technique is very insistent. If you read Kevin Randall's recounting, because he investigated this case firsthand with Dr. Harder, it's hard to read. It really is. And again, why are we regressing children? That is just like a big no-no. Don't regress children. Just don't do it. Harder regressed Patty again and learned that the craft was hovering 80 feet away from the house. The beings had no apprehension, walking through the house from room to room, retrieving the children, one at a time. Again, she wouldn't talk about her examination, which she did say included a gynecological exam, but she was angry. Angry with the beings for stealing her thoughts. In detail, she described the process. It began with a needle inserted into the front of her head. Quote, "They don't know how we humans are," Patty said. "I called them stupid." Patty also described a human-looking man who was tall and assisted with the examination. Here's a direct quote from Kevin Randall's The October Scenario. She described his eyes, regular human eyes. Then she began talking about the needles that were pushed into her and some of the things that the aliens had done. She told us that she was standing on a cliff, watching the waves roll slowly to shore. Her voice became quiet and monotonous. The sea scene and the repetition suggested that she was being hypnotized by the aliens. Now she remembers what they had asked. What I love, what I hate, what animals I like. They asked about my family. They manipulated me. Why did you think that? I had no choice. What kind of information do you think they wanted? They need us. What? I don't know why they need us. We waited a moment, but Pat remained silent. Finally, she said, "They were very intent. They need information quickly. I don't know if it's my imagination, but they limit time." That was confusing. Harder asked her to say it again. "They limit time, and we don't." What gave you the impression that they had a limited amount of time? Pat interrupted me. "Not amount of time. I don't know what it means, just that they limit time." For a few minutes, she described the feelings that were building. We wanted to know if they had her in hypnosis, but she didn't know. We asked if it was similar to the feeling that she had now, and she said, "That's why I don't like this." The exam on the craft ended, and she remembered putting on her clothes. The aliens didn't help but stood waiting. Pat was becoming concerned about her children. She asked where they were, and when the aliens didn't say anything, Pat was afraid that they had been hurt. She started to cry and asked for her children. Harder told her it was all right and her children were safe. She came out of the trance on her own. She described him as a 55-year-old man with a fringe of gray hair around his head. He wore glasses and dressed in black, and had his hand in a rubber glove. He seemed nice. Her daughter Bonnie confirmed what her mother had said, claiming to see humans on board the craft as well. So Bonnie gets at the idea that there are humans on this object. Not only that, her daughter Bonnie sees them as well. The one that she interacted with was this 55-year-old man who basically had the Hulk Hogan horseshoe going around the head. After that, they brought them back into their home. And I think what's interesting here, even though there was regression done on children, and again, I hate it so fucking much, but Bonnie was able to confirm a lot of the information that Patty had given. It's unclear whether Bonnie heard her say it at other times, but it's just an interesting feature of this particular incident because it does involve so many people. And There does seem to be certain levels of confirmation, but regardless, I fucking hate it. Much love to Patty and her family, though, because it takes a lot to come forward and talk about stuff like this. And that is going to do it for this episode of The Hum in the Silence. Thank y'all for supporting what I do here. I love y'all so much. Special thanks to Floats for the use of their song UFO as the theme for this podcast, and to Megan Lagerberg for our logo. And finally, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in our strange skies or on your long-haul route just outside of Cape Girardeau. In gray, we trust.